Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today.
I think it is unconscionable that they would want to build a mosque here because you're building a shrine to the very ideology that inspired those jihadist attacks.
Why does Comedy Central give such deference to Islam while mocking Christianity? Is it because they confuse the civility of Christianity with weakness?
Go read one of the presidential proclamations about the National Day of Prayer and Kwanzaa and Ramadan, and all of a sudden, Constantine doesn't look like this dead figure of history. He's living and breathing on Pennsylvania Avenue.
My name is Mike. I'm a fan of Law and Order. I'm a believer in Law and Gospel, and I love Issues Etc.
You spend your entire professional career reading and studying the theology of a guy like 16th century reformer Martin Luther. And then, I've been a Lutheran pastor for 20 years. And then one day, you find out something about Luther that you didn't know. And not just something minor, but something rather major, something that greatly influenced him and actually what could have turned out to be, but didn't, could have turned out to be a real major work from Martin Luther, unfinished work, as it turns out to be. It has to do with that 16th century reformer, Martin Luther, and what is familiar to so many of us, even today, Aesop's fables. They are fables from, well, some say 5th or 6th century B.C. Luther knew them. He knew most of them. He even was working on a critical edition of them, but never finished it. We're going to be talking about Luther and Aesop's fables and why he thought they were so useful. Here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. on this Monday, June the 7th, I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. After a half hour's conversation with Dr. Carl Springer on that subject, Deaconess Pam Nielsen joins us from Concordia Publishing House. Today, God divides the Jordan River. It's just like out of Egypt into the promised land, God performs this miracle. We'll talk about that with Pam. In the second hour of the program, Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse will be our guest. We'll get her thoughts on judicial activism. And then Peter Hitchens is going to join us. The name sounds familiar. It should. He is the brother of famous atheist Christopher Hitchens. He's written a new book titled Rage Against God, How Atheism Led Me to Faith. We'll talk about the case against atheism. Peter Hitchens, our guest in the last 45 minutes of Issues Etc. As I said, it's Monday, June the 7th. We're coming to you live, and you can join us for the next 2 hours. 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Email us here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org. You can Twitter us at @issuesetc. Joining us to talk about Martin Luther and Aesop's fables, Dr. Carl Springer. He's Associate Dean and Professor of the College of Arts and Sciences at Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville, Illinois, not too far from here. And he's author of an article in the Logia Journal titled Luther's Aesop, also subject of a forthcoming book. Dr. Springer, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. It's good to be here.
How did you discover Luther's interest in, more than just an interest in, a real academic and professional interest in these ancient fables?
Well, I've always been interested in the interaction between classics and Christianity, and I did my doctoral dissertation on a biblical epic poet and hymnist in late antiquity named Sedulius. And I was very interested in Sedulius in part because I've been a Lutheran all my life long, and I knew that Luther was interested in Sedulius and translated his hymns. And so after spending a number of years working with Sedulius, I began to get interested in the question of what was Luther's relationship with the classical tradition, what was his relationship with Virgil and Homer and, of course, the Greek philosophers like Aristotle. And as I began to look into this question more carefully, Aesop's name kept popping up again and again. It turns out that Luther was very decidedly opposed to Aristotle and Epicurus, these famous Greek philosophers, but he really loved Latin poets like Virgil and He just was crazy about the fables of Aesop. He said, next to the Bible, they're the best thing we have for teaching morality.
He was even working on what we would call today a critical edition of Aesop's fables. What do we have left of this? Do we have something like a manuscript? Do we have notes? When was he working on this?
Well, in 1530, when the whole Augsburg diet was going on, Luther couldn't go down to Augsburg along with Melanchthon and others. And so he stayed in Coburg, just north of the border, and he had a little time on his hands there. So he wrote a letter to Philip Melanchthon early on there and said, Philip, I really miss you. While you're down there in Augsburg, I'm going to create three tabernacles here on my Mount Sinai, if you will, one for the prophets, one for the Psalms, and one for Aesop. And we actually have the manuscript that he began but didn't finish there. He did 13 fables, and that manuscript was discovered in the Vatican Library, of all places, in the 1880s. And we have all his scribbles and scratches, and, you know, he added morals and then changed his mind. But we get a real good glimpse into how Luther, how valuable he thought they were, and how carefully he wanted to work them and rework them for use in the Lutheran family home, primarily, but also in Lutheran schools.
Tell us, I mean, most of us know Aesop's fables simply as they might know one or two of them. The origins of these things, and especially of Aesop, are a little murky. There's a lot of contradictory testimony in the ancient world about this man and his work. What do we know about the man and the fables themselves that is fairly reliable?
Very little indeed. And Luther, interestingly, was pretty skeptical about that. And we have a preface that he wrote for the collection of fables that he never finished. But the preface is pretty complete. And in the preface, he says, I doubt that there was anybody who ever was named Aesop or whoever actually lived and wrote these fables. I think they kind of were accumulated over time. And he may be right about some of that. I think there's a lot of the fables that predate what would have been Aesop's times. And there's a lot of fables that come from other cultures. There's a lot of fables that were added in the Middle Ages. But a lot of scholars do think there was maybe somebody named Aesop who was maybe a slave, maybe from the island of Samos. His name may have something to do with the Greek word for Ethiopian. So the legend, there's a legendary life of Aesop that was very popular in the Middle Ages. And it talks about how he was originally dumb, mute, and he was given the gift of speech. And was very unprepossessing to look at. He was ugly, bandy, you know, knock-kneed and bandy-legged.
All the artist depictions of him, he looks kind of dwarf-like, kind of grotesque in his...
Big stomach. But he had these beautiful words that came out of his mouth once he was given the gift of speech. And he his story, the story of his life, legendary though it may be, is really interesting, and Luther liked it. Because he eventually ends up going to Delphi, the home of the great god Apollo, the Greek great Greek god Apollo, and there he starts criticizing the way he often did the authorities, the religious authorities, the people. He was one to speak his mind, and they got so mad at him they threw him off a cliff, even though he told them several good fables about why they shouldn't do that.
Did Luther ever express any affinity for that aspect of the legend, at least the legend for Aesop, seeing himself perhaps as present-day Aesop?
He doesn't say so in so many words, but he also talks and writes a lot about Aesop, not just in this 1530 manuscript, but throughout his works. And elsewhere, he talks about Aesop and says, you know, here's somebody who can really speak well. He speaks the truth. And the trouble with speaking the truth is you're always going to get persecuted. And everybody hates the truth when it hits home. And it's hard for me not to think that Luther did see himself a little bit in that role. He, too, wasn't an aristocrat. He, too, was somebody who spoke truth to people in positions of high authority, people, religious authorities of his day. So I do think there was an affinity there. And Luther loved animals. He loved his dog, Topol. the little fool. In fact, one cute story, he's sitting at the table and he's eating something, and Topol's looking at him the way a dog looks at you when you're eating something. And Luther comments, look at my little dog. If only I could pray the way this dog looks at me. That attention, that concentration is magnificent. So he loved birds. He loved his dog. He had a real sense, I think, for animals, and also, of course, a keen interest in educating children.
I want to come back to that on the other side of the break, but with about a minute and a half before we take this break, do you get any indication from Luther's work on Aesop's fables which of the fables might have been his favorite?
Yes, the one he cites most often is the story of the dog and the bone, or the piece of meat in his mouth. Do you know that one?
Where he drops it into the water.
Right, because he's looking at the reflection of the bone in the water and thinks he can get another one. And so for Luther, that illustrates the folly of greed, where we're so eager to get something that we don't have that we forget and neglect what we already do have. And then we end up being really in a bad position because we lose both things, the thing that we had and the thing that we hoped we would have.
When we come back, we know that the 16th century reformer Martin Luther was not only intensely interested in what we've come to call the Reformation of the Church, but he saw this not only taking place at the altar and in the pulpit, he saw it taking place at what he would have said, the hearth in the home. He's very concerned, and also set a fairly good example in his own family eventually for this kind of reformation of the family. Of course, if you read the Small Catechism, it's written for the family. It's written for fathers and their children. When we come back, we'll talk about Luther's hopes for Aesop's fables in that context, that of the Christian family. Dr. Carl Springer of Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville, Illinois, is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
A great resource for Sunday school teachers. Mondays, we interview Deaconess Pam Nielsen of Concordia Publishing House about the upcoming Growing in Christ Sunday School lesson. You'll find these interviews under the Listen on Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. Listen to a 20-minute interview with Pam Nielsen and you'll be prepared to teach Sunday school this weekend. issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand and look for Teaching a Sunday School Lesson with Deaconess Pam Nielsen.
Catechesis, God's way of teaching faith in Christ and love to the neighbor. The Concordia Catechetical Academy presents its annual symposium on catechesis in Waukesha, Wisconsin, June 16th through the 18th. This year's theme, the first article of the Creed. Presentations include catechesis on the first three chapters of Genesis, the fatherhood of God, Christ and creation, atheism, evolution, and the Christian faith and life. Register online at peacesussex.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House. Listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House. cph.org.
Historic liturgy. Cool. Liturgical dance. Not cool. Kneeling for the Lord's body and blood on a Sunday morning. Cool. Sitting in your theater-style seat with cupful if you're a double mocha latte. Not cool. We're the Brothers of John the Steadfast. If you're interested in traditional Lutheran doctrine and practice, check us out, www.steadfastlutherans.com. You are
my soul.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Monday afternoon, June the 7th. Coming to you live, talking about Martin Luther and Aesop's fables. Dr. Carl Springer is our guest. He's author of an article in the Logia Journal titled Luther's Aesop. It's also the subject of a forthcoming book from him. Dr. Springer, let's talk about the end to which Luther, I imagine he used them in sermons and all sorts of commentaries, things like that. But it appears that his goal was for these to be used in the home, similar to the use of the small catechism that he wrote for the home. What was his concern there?
I think if you look at the pattern in which Luther uses these fables and the way in which he uses them throughout his life, you'll see that the way in which he uses them changes from more of a polemical kind of a purpose in his early career, where he would talk about the story of the donkey and the lion's skin in terms of criticizing the Pope, to becoming much more interested in their pedagogical purposes. And it may be linked just simply to the fact that he had children of his own. But when he writes his preface to this collection of fables that he was preparing on the Coburg, he ends up by talking about how it might be used. And at that point, he specifically mentions the father of a household after dinner would use these fables and tell them to folks gathered around his table. Could be servants, could be his own children. And Luther says he'll explain them in terms of what they might mean for those people in those individual circumstances.
So moral instruction, in essence.
Absolutely.
I remember when I was a very young father coming across a picture book that just fascinated me. It was called Classics to be Read Aloud. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It was an illustrated picture book for kids to be read by parents, but it was kind of a simplified form of Aesop's fables and then some other fable material from largely from Greek and Roman antiquity, stories that everybody's familiar with. Taking some of the classical mythology, Narcissus and things like that, which is very much that kind of morality play. It sounds like Luther was so far ahead of his time in terms of how he thought these things could be used in the family.
He really wanted to rescue Aesop, I think, from the ways in which Aesop could be misused or misinterpreted or misread as though Aesop was simply for fun. Or simply a kind of diversion. And he did see that there was something very useful and edifying about these fables that could be very valuable for Lutheran children, for Lutheran families. And I think that was his main purpose, was to try to help Lutheran families have other resources besides the Bible that they could read aloud and get their kids into the classical tradition for what was really valuable about it. He was very interested in having Lutherans who were well-educated. He loved the languages and wanted the languages to be continued. Aesop was one of the authors that was read in the Latin schools that Melanchthon helped set up in what we would maybe call the second grade. And in his case, the case of the Coburg collection, Luther is translating them into German, so they can be used by everybody, regardless of whether they know Latin or not. But I think that's a key purpose for his use of them, is that they would help to complement and corroborate the kind of instruction that you have in the Ten Commandments and in the Table of Duties, many of which also have the same familiar sound. What does this mean? Mm-hmm. And every single fable that Luther retells in the Coburg collection has a bunch of morals at the end and proverbs. And he always says, what does this mean? What's the teaching? What does this fable show us?
Talk about the context here, because this is something that is often also unrecognized about Luther. I think his secular descendants realize this more than we who are his theological descendants. And that is that Luther was part of a great sweep of Christian humanism that in that day didn't mean what it means today, secular humanism. Talk about that, the return to the sources that he and Melanchthon were so much a part of.
Yes, I think that Luther celebrated debate and dispute with Erasmus, where Erasmus talks about really the freedom of the human will, and Luther is very much committed to the idea of the bondage of the will, sometimes has misled people into thinking that Luther really wanted a clean break with the whole classical tradition and all of the values of liberal education. But in fact, that's far from the truth. Luther was very comfortable with classical authors who did not express those kinds of sentiments, the the belief that Aristotle and others had that human beings can become better by being better themselves. He was very interested, though, in poets like Homer and Virgil and Aesop and the worldview that they represent, where it's much more a world where human beings are bound, where human beings are like animals. They are subject to their own, in this case, their own original sin. The old Adam within them is what makes them greedy, what makes us greedy. And so Luther could very easily go back and forth between Aesop's view of the dog, who can't help but go after that reflection, because that's just part of the dog's nature. The dog wants more. and for us then, too, our sinful nature is at the heart of what makes this true. These stories are true because human beings fundamentally are greedy as well. And that's what's so valuable about having these stories taught at an early age. Don't be greedy. Here's what can happen. And that's what the father is supposed to be telling the kids as they sit around the table.
It also seems to go hand in hand with Luther's strong belief, which has been lost largely in the Western world, in natural law, that there is a law written on the heart of man, and that this is also a law that governs the affairs of man generally. He seemed to be, especially when he talked about the civil realm, quite a strong advocate of that. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think he was not a social engineer. He did not believe that the law or the gospel was necessarily going to make the world a better place in which to live. He was disappointed, I think, when the Reformation didn't pan out in terms of changing behavior in Wittenberg, and threatened to leave at one point. He was so disgusted with the kinds of blatant misbehavior that was going on in the 1540s.
Sometimes in the name of the gospel, it was being done that way.
Right. Yeah. But again, I think you're absolutely right. Luther didn't see the fables as necessarily making the world a perfect place. The world is still the world, according to Luther. And that world is a fallen world. And it's a world in which it's important for Christians to live carefully and safely and wisely and be as innocent as doves and as wise as serpents. And he didn't believe Aesop's fables could teach everything. He said Aesop's fables are really excellent when it comes to something like morality. The heathen, he said, teach great things when it comes to morality. Even Aristotle has some wise things to say. But Moses is the place where you can learn a lot about worship. Mm-hmm. So he understood that Aesop's fables are not the same as the Bible. They're second to the Bible when it comes to instructing morality. But again, he was very eager to embrace that and continue that great tradition. And it is odd to me that Lutherans of all people today would be so willing to just do away with, say, great books or with Greek or Latin and that traditional curriculum that was set up by Luther and Melanchthon.
That's what I wanted to ask about last, and that is the value of, if not a classical education in the technical sense, returning to the great works, returning to the great writings, ancient, near, modern, all of these. I think if Luther and Melanchthon were to stand together and assess their, especially in America, their theological descendants, they'd say, wow, these people need to learn how to think again, think like a good rational people, and they can do this through education in the classics. Your thoughts there with about a minute.
Absolutely. I think the value of the old-fashioned trivium, the grammar, rhetoric, logic, those kinds of basic intellectual skills that were taught in schools in the Middle Ages and continue to be taught in Lutheran schools through the generations after Luther, I think those are really valuable. Think about it this way. Luther's reformation of the liturgy was very conservative. He embraced and maintained much of the medieval heritage of the liturgy. And I think the same thing was true of the curriculum, the academic curriculum. And Lutherans today, some have kept the liturgical elements that are so common to Lutheranism through the ages. But it doesn't seem they have the same kind of dedication to maintaining that curriculum.
Dr. Carl Springer is Associate Dean and Professor of the College of Arts and Sciences at Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville, Illinois. He's author of an article in the Logia Journal titled Luther's Aesop and a forthcoming book on the same subject. When do you think you'll be finished with the book?
I'm hoping to get some of the finishing touches on this summer and have it out for publishers to take a look at.
Do you think anyone will ever take up a pen to paper and finish Luther's unfinished work on Aesop?
It would be wonderful. There. It turns out there were a lot of Lutheran fable writers after Luther. In my last chapter, I talk about all of the people who tried their hand at Nathan Catreus, for instance. Did try to finish the project. So it isn't fair to say that it was left undone. Other people came along and finished it. They were very popular, as you noted, in the 16th and 17th centuries.
Thank you for being our guest.
You're welcome.
When we come back from this break, Pam Nielsen will be joining us, as she usually does on Mondays. We'll be teaching a Sunday school lesson today, God Divides the Jordan River, giving his people safe and dry passage into the land that he had promised. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me. Amen." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths in the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly or annual contributor to Issues Etc. To find out how you can become an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron, check out the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. Just look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation, Scripture, faith, grace, and Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc. and you.
Real Reformation Radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
New evidence shows most women who have abortions are pressured or forced into the procedure. This is the finding of the Elliott Institute, which says the problem is a widespread epidemic. Research suggests 64% of abortions are unwanted or coerced. And a huge majority of women, 80%, says they didn't receive the counseling they needed to make a decision to abort. There's a growing body of evidence showing many women who refuse to abort their unborn babies have been subjected to violent attacks and sometimes death. In the U.S., homicide's the leading cause of death among pregnant women. So where are all the so-called pro-choice organizations? So far, they've been stone silent on this issue. This silence is costing women their health and lives.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.